This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. As we continue this Veterans Day edition, we hear the story of two former fighter pilots who were shot down over North Vietnam and held prisoner of war, an experience that included repeated torture. They're among the men featured in the documentary Return with Honor about the POWs who were released in 1973. The film is being rebroadcast on public television Monday night. North Vietnam did not observe the Geneva Convention's rules on the treatment of POWs. They called their captured Americans war criminals. Ronald Bliss was held prisoner of war for 6.5 years. After his release, he went to law school. He's now a partner in a firm handling intellectual property and technology. Ed McIntyre spent nearly 6 years as a POW and stayed in the military. He's now a major general in the Air Force Reserve. He also works for private aerospace companies. Terry asked them each to describe how they bailed out after being shot down. Ron Bliss answered first.
I had electrical fire in the front part of the aircraft and a lot of gray smoke and a lot of heat, and it just got hotter and hotter. And about 8 seconds after the pop-up, after I'd already pickled off my bombs hot just in case they tried to carry them south for booby traps, I got out. So I imagine it took about a minute and a half to really punch out, but I knew subconsciously at about the 30-second mark that I'd had it.
Ed McIntyre, you say something really extraordinary in the movie Return with Honor. You stayed in the plane. You were dealing with it, and when you bailed out, the plane crashed about 1.5 seconds after you got out.
Yeah, Ron was a single-engine, single-seat airplane that he was flying, so he didn't have the privilege I did of having somebody. I was flying an F-4C Phantom, which had two people in it. I had myself and a pilot systems operator about 6 feet behind me. And a fighter pilot, you're always in control. If you don't think that you're the world's greatest fighter pilot, you aren't. And one of the things about a fighter pilot is you are in control. Mm-hmm. And I can do this. Don't bother me, as I say in a movie. I had a wonderful gentleman, a classmate of Ron's and mine from the Air Force Academy, Kevin McManus, behind me, and he said, "Ed, I don't think we're going to make it." And that kind of jogged me out of this thing. I can fly out of this. But by then, the airplane was a complete fireball. And when Kevin and I ejected upside down, 620 knots, going down at 45 degrees nose low, we came out of a fireball. There was nothing left of the airplane except these two seats that came out of the bottom of the fireball. And before the parachutes opened, the airplane hit the ground.
What was going through your mind on the way down?
Please don't hit me, because there were lots of people down there shooting at me. I had a 38 caliber pistol, which was full of tracers, which I knew was not a weapon. It was more of a signaling device. And we were coming down into a populated area, and there were just a lot of people down there shooting at us. And you just see the bullets go whipping while you couldn't see them. You could hear them going by, and you look up and see the holes in the canopy above you.
Well, it must be quite a feeling of helplessness.
Complete helplessness, yes.
Ronald Bliss, were you being shot at on the way down, too?
Well, I was unconscious, so I don't know.
You were unconscious?
I went out just below the speed of sound, about Mach 0.93, and that in itself is, as Ed will testify, somewhat of a miracle to survive that. But I woke up on the ground, stripped down to my underwear, lying on a dirt road, judging from the sun, about 2 to 3 hours later, and they marched me to the little village where the fun began after that. So I don't know what happened on the way down. They always tell you to be nice and relaxed so you don't hurt yourself when you land, and I assure you, I was as relaxed as you could be.
Were you conscious long enough to pull the cord and open the parachute?
Well, it's automatic. I squeezed the triggers.
Oh.
I had the canopy off already trying to cool it down because I had a lot of smoke and fire in the cockpit, but that released the back pressure and it got worse. So I said, I was talking to myself. I said, Tampa 4 is punching out. I'll see you when the war's over. And I didn't have any radio. I didn't know it. But I went out. That's the last I remember. I don't remember any of the parachute ride down, but the seat automatically separates from you and the parachute automatically opens. And it's wonderful equipment. It worked.
Ed McIntyre, were you taken prisoner of war pretty immediately after landing?
We landed right in the middle of them, and as Ron says, you know, on the way down, they were shooting at us, and you're trying to get rid of your survival radios and get yourself prepared to land. And I landed right on top of a little building and rolled down and presented myself to the Vietnamese, completely tied up in my shroud lines. So, yeah, we were completely surrounded by about a cast of 100 immediately upon hitting the ground.
What does your military training tell you to do if you're captured?
Well, ideally, you hold out for a few seconds by giving them name, rank, service number, and date of birth. But that doesn't last long, or you'll be dead before the night is upon you. So what you have to do for interrogation is to make up a plausible story, sound sincere, and frankly, just give them garbage. And you realize, and you're trained this way under the code of conduct, if you have an opportunity to escape, you must take it. Albeit where we were, it was impossible, and that's a long story. But secondly, you never lose faith with your fellow man, and you try to contact him as soon as possible because you're all in the same pot of soup together, and you just need to hang in there.
What were the first things that happened to you after you were taken captive?
Well, everybody went through an area we called New Guy Village, or Heartbreak Hotel, and it was a very intense area where they were trying to convince you that because they had complete control of your body, you ought to tell them everything you want and be completely cooperative. It was not a very sophisticated intellectual discussion. It was strictly a brute force effort to bring you down to a level to where they thought you would do anything and everything they ask you to do.
And I'd like you each to describe the cells that you were in, or the prisons that you were in. Ron Bliss, would you start?
Well, the first one in Heartbreak Hotel, a special part of the Hanoi Hilton where they break you down, was a wooden bedboard with permanent rusty leg irons on it. The room was 3.5 paces wide and 4 paces long, and it was all bricked up. There was a screen over the window and a light bulb, but it was on day and night, and it was filthy. And this is a comment I think I made in the movie, that when you walk into this place, it was built by the French for the Viet Minh. You can hear the screams of over 50 years. It's a very serious place.
And then where were you taken after that?
Because the fellow that was there at the same time, and I mean that literally, Jack Fellows, the naval officer, lost the use of his arms for about 8 or 9 months because of the Vietnamese rope trick. We were thrown together after, I don't know, I lost track, about 8 or 10 days, and moved to a camp called The Zoo. It's an old French movie colony that they converted to a prison camp. And we were there inside of 2 weeks, and that's where I spent probably half to two-thirds of my total time in captivity, not at one time, but back and forth to The Zoo.
Ed Meckenbauer, were you there as well?
Yeah, I spent about 3 years at The Zoo, but like Ron, it seemed like about once every year, probably to, in their own mind, make themselves believe that they had disrupted any kind of a communication routine that we had, a communication network we had within the camps. They'd move you around to different places. So over the 6 years, I lived in 8 different places, from downtown in the Wallo prison, the Hanoi Hilton, to The Zoo, to another place we called The Plantation because it was an old plantation house with a movie studio associated with that. I spent about a year there. Spent about 8 months up a camp on the Chinese border, another place called Dog Patch, and various other places around town. So they moved you around occasionally.
Ed Meckenbauer and Ron Bliss, two of the former POWs featured in the documentary Return with Honor. More of Terry's interview with them after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue Terry's interview with Ron Bliss and Ed Meckenbauer, fighter pilots who were shot down over North Vietnam and held as prisoners of war for 6 years.
Now, Ron Bliss had mentioned that his cellmate had lost his use of his arms through the Vietnamese rope trick. Now, the rope trick is a word for a specific type of torture that the Vietnamese used. How often were you tortured during your over 6 years of captivity?
Ron, go ahead and throw in about the Hanoi March, which is a different kind of torture.
Just before I was shot down, Ho Chi Minh and his cronies, we had a big airstrike on their oil storage plant in Hanoi, and it shattered their confidence and it shattered their propaganda invincibility. So they marched, chained two by two, all the existing POWs down through Hanoi and whipped up the crowd to the point where the Vietnamese guards actually lost control of the crowd, and a lot of our people really got worked over very, very heavily. And I still remember, I think it was the London Times commenting that not since Caesar brought Vercingetorix down from Gaul after he captured him had any spectacle so humiliating ever occurred. One thing that happens to you is, generally speaking, at least for the first 3 years of captives, you go through the rope trick. The rope trick is very simple. There are variations on a theme, but it goes like this. They'll manacle your hands behind you. In my case, it was rigid wrist irons. They throw you down on the floor, face down. They put a rope around your elbows, and they put a bamboo pole through the rope, and they just start cranking it all down. The first thing you feel is your wrists may break. Next, your elbows feel like they could come out of the socket, and then your shoulders may come out of the socket, and then you have back problems. And you have trouble breathing. But there are all sorts of tortures other than that. Food deprivation, sleep deprivation. I was under the Cuban interrogation program for a while, and he killed a man next door to me. It took about 3 years for him to die, but I got worked over with a fan belt. I was black and blue for about 6 months after that. There are all sorts of things that they can do at their whim.
Now, how much did these torture sessions actually have goals? Did you have a sense that the people torturing you were sadists who were just enjoying the act of torturing somebody, or were they really determined to get information, and did they seem to believe that they'd be able to get it this way?
I think individually some of them actually thought that, you know, that they could get information like that. There were others who I think just thoroughly enjoyed. In fact, we had one guy we called Psycho. I think he just thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity to physically abuse another person's body. I don't know that after a period of time anybody on the Vietnamese side really ever thought it was going to be effective. And if you resisted, if they didn't get what you wanted, you know, then they'd try something else or they'd go try somebody else. So then, again, it was up to the individual to do the best he could. And it comes out in the movie as well. We didn't judge if a guy lasted 5 hours or 5 days or 5 months or if he went the entire period and never did it. You just do the best you can, as much, you know, just for your own personal honor, but it's just to make them, next time they get interested in some information or they want some propaganda, they go try somebody else who might be an easier target.
So what's the closest each of you came to feeling like you had reached the breaking point? And no matter
me,
what
it, there were two or three times, but I remember early on, since I was shot down in a Joint Chief of Staff target, they publicized my ID card picture and everything else in the Vietnam Courier, and it was I didn't know this for months, but it was a big deal. And we were not living too badly under the circumstances, except they were boiling our brains out in this little hot room we were in. But everybody thought, everybody around me, that maybe they were trying to set me up for an early release, which was not going to happen. So after about six or seven-month period, the camp commander of the lump called me in and asked me what I thought about the treatment, and I told him, and he totally lost it. And he made up for lost time over the summer of 67 in a dirty, I mean, blazing hot room. It just radiated all night long, and we would sleep on the floor with the mosquitoes eating us, no mosquito net at all, just to get our nose up by the crack under the door, maybe you get one breath of air a night. And they were working us over pretty well physically, and it was a bad time in the war. We knew we weren't doing well in the air war. And at the end of 67, the end of summer of 67, I gave one of my last formal prayers there to myself, and I said, "Dear God, if it's going to be this bad again, just turn out the lights. I don't want to do it." But we never gave in.
Did you ever seriously entertain the idea of suicide?
Yeah, but I don't think I can run fast enough to crush my skull on the cell wall. And every time I shaved, I had a guard there. I couldn't cut my wrist with a razor blade. So really, that's academic. The answer would be I considered it, but not that seriously.
I'm too big a coward. I wouldn't do it.
Well, that's interesting that you say you're too big a coward to do it. But, you know, here you are facing all this torture. So, you know, that's not what a coward wants, is torture.
Oh, no, I mean, it's just that I couldn't stand the sight of my own blood. I might hurt myself. If they're going to hurt me, that's okay. I mean, but I'm not going to add to that. I'm not going to help them.
The only way that people really consider suicide, I think, is when they are alone and not in communication right. with their fellow man. And if as long as you can talk to somebody around you, that gives you such an enormous strength as a human being that you can find a way to carry on. And people will ask you the question. They don't know what else to ask. They'll say, well, what made you get through it? Well, frankly, it's a different answer for each day. Some days were so mm-hmm. bad, you just look at the guard and quietly think to yourself, Nguyen, you can't kill me today. I'm not going to die. And maybe the next day I remember my lovely wife and I want to see her again, or the child who's never seen me. But it was not one answer for the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And you got to remember, I mean, I had the privilege of living with Ron Bliss during one of those years.
So, I mean, so if you lived somebody, together for a year.
Oh, yeah, we lived together.
Oh, we
for about
did,
a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had an apartment.
We had a rock and roll group of four young lieutenants, and just because of we all three of us had the same date of rank, and my name started with BL instead of anything else, so I became a senior guy for a year as a lieutenant. Can you imagine living in a room with Ed Meckenbauer, Kevin McManus, and a gentleman that you don't know, Galen Kramer, and being a senior man? That's more fun than you should ever be entitled to.
How were you told that you were going to be released? Ed Meckenbauer, do you want to start?
Well, for the first time ever, we were back in the Hanoi Hilton. For the first time ever, the Vietnamese got us all outside and allowed us to stand in what would pass for a fairly decent military formation. And they read to us the protocols concerning the release of POWs that had been agreed to. Now, interestingly enough, this was 5 days and maximum amount of time after the signing that they were allowed to tell us. And so they went right to the 11th hour, the 59th minute, and all the rest of that to tell us. And two or three days before, they knew the war was over, obviously, but they kept telling us it was going to last forever. So at the last minute, they drug us all outside and they read the protocols and generically told us how we would go home in four equal groups approximating the withdrawal of each quarter of the American troops remaining in South Vietnam. And as it says in the movie, interestingly enough, there wasn't any, you know, ripping off your shirts and jumping up and down and yelling and screaming. It was all kind of, okay, yeah, I believe it when it happens. And everybody just kind of quietly went back into their cells.
Ron Bliss, what was the sweetest moment for you after your release or after being told that you would be released?
The sweetest moment. It would have to be a combination of two things. Number one, arriving at Clark Air Base and seeing the wonderful welcome of John Q. Citizen, who was there in the Philippines on the air base, going into an air-conditioned hospital room where we had a soft bed, which I couldn't sleep on. We'd been sleeping on concrete and wood for years, with clean sheets and a pitcher of water with ice cubes in it. I mean, we're talking first class now, right? But the biggest thrill, I think, was at midnight that first night when I finally got to call home and talk to Charlene for the first time.
Your wife?
My wife, Charlene, had been pretty close to 7 years by the time I'd had the chance to talk to her yet. And I had a son that was not quite 2 months old when I left. And 30 days after I returned to the States, he turned seven. So I was looking forward to seeing him. He's quite a young lad. He's a good man. How sweet it is.
Ed Meckenbauer, what about you?
I think Ron hit it right on the head. I mean, you find out what's really important in life, and it's those with whom you are blessed to share life. And so every stage along the way, the people in the hospital were wonderful. All of the people who greeted us in the Philippines and at Travis and in San Francisco and the wonderful people here in Dayton, Ohio. When I got back here, it was 21 degrees below zero that night. We got back at 1:30 in the morning. And there were hundreds of people out there in that flight line. Those are all, it's not one moment. It was just a cascade of joy. And like Ron says, getting back with the family, I mean, that really kind of put the punctuation mark on it and says, okay, now I'm ready to start the rest of my life because I've got the things that I think and hold close and are cherishable, they're back together now.
Ed Meckenbeyer and Ron Bliss, two of the former POWs featured in the documentary Return with Honor. It's being rebroadcast on public television Monday night. Coming up, a review of the new military drama starring Robert De Niro and Cuba Gooding Jr. This is Fresh Air.